Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, is former U.S. House Speaker Newt Gingrich responsible for damaging the culture and productivity of the U.S. Senate? Then, so-called memory entrepreneurs try to change how we remember the past in efforts to shape the future. Did they lose the Cold War memory fight? Can one person change a long-established institution and destroy its culture? Our next guest says yes and argues that former House Speaker Newt Gingrich has been that person to the U.S. Senate. Through Gingrich's tactics and political activities, the Senate is unrecognizable to past senators and scholars who have studied the body. What exactly was Gingrich's role in damaging the Senate's culture and productivity? Sean Theriault joins us. Sean Theriault is a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of The Power of the People, Congressional Competition, Public Attention, and Voter Attribution, Party Polarization in Congress, and his latest, The Gingrich Senators, The Roots of Partisan Warfare in Congress. Welcome, Sean Theriault.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you here. This book, The Gingrich Senators, you're documenting essentially what you see as the turn of the Senate in particular into this very polarized body. You started with a particular vignette. I thought it was a really great way to illustrate it with Senator DeMint. Tell us what happened and how that sort of illustrates what you saw happening.
What we have coming out of the 2008 election is the Republican Party is split because they see that Obama won in a pretty huge way. And so half of the Republicans in the Senate thought that they needed to go along with Obama, kind of get on board with some of the agenda items that he had. But then the other half of the Republican Party thought that he needed to be stopped at every turn. And so early on, there's a Republican conference meeting. And Jim DeMint makes it his priority that he's going to stop Obamacare. And so coming out of that Republican conference when he announces his opposition, Republicans are furious at him because they think that they need to still play the conciliatory game with Obama. And DeMint says, no, we need to stop them at every cost. And so what happens is that Jim DeMint ends up being the primary force that stops Obama on lots of his different agenda items, certainly makes Obamacare much more difficult. But not only Obamacare, but also the financial overhaul bill becomes much more difficult because of him. Environmental legislation becomes much more difficult. And what we get by the end of that Congress is the entire Republican Party almost on board with Jim DeMint's agenda, and it becomes wrapped up into the Tea Party, and we have the 2010 election, where after the 2010 election, the entire Republican Party is transformed, not only in the Senate, but in the House as well because of the Tea Party. And we can trace it almost exactly to Jim DeMint and who he supports and how they do in the 2010 election.
And you trace him and the other what you call Gingrich senators to 1978 was when you brought Newt Gingrich into the stage.
Right.
What was it that characterized Newt Gingrich? First of all, he was in the House. He wasn't even in the Senate.
No.
But this ended up getting into the Senate.
That's right. So what Newt Gingrich does, he brings a different style of politics to Washington, D.C. Because before Newt Gingrich, the Republicans thought that they were a permanent minority. And so they thought that the only way that they were going to have an influence on legislation was if they got along with the Democratic chairs of the committees, if they offered their amendments and perhaps got some conservative Democrats to go along with them, and that they would have their influence in very marginal ways. And Newt Gingrich comes in and says, look, if we want to be a major player in this town, we have to stop cooperating. We need to get in front of Democrats, try and stop them at every turn, give the voters a clear choice, and then what we can hope to do is ride the unpopularity of Congress to electoral victory. And what happens 2 years after Newt Gingrich introduces this new style of politics, if we have Ronald Reagan winning. When Ronald Reagan wins in 1980, he brings with him a bunch of Republicans into the Senate. And Republicans are finally the majority party, not only in the White House, but in the Senate as well. And the problem for the House Republicans is they look at their friends who are in the Senate and they see them chairing committees. They look down at the White House. They see a Republican in the White House, but yet they're still in the minority. And they will be in the minority for 14 years. But it's only through the persistent efforts of Newt Gingrich over those 14 years to differentiate the House Republicans from the House Democrats that ultimately we get this huge wave in 1994 that brings the Republicans to the majority party. And it's all because of the politics of confrontation that Newt Gingrich introduces.
Let's talk about how he did that. There was a particular, it wasn't a caucus, it was the
Conservative Opportunity Society.
That's right.
That's right. The Conservative Opportunity Society. And what he does is he gets some of the backbencher Republicans who are sick of playing along with the Democrats and only having a marginal influence in legislation, and he starts forming this informal group. And they start we're changing the way that the House operates as an institution. So instead of going on to the House floor before the official legislation happens or at the end of a legislative day, where other members of Congress might talk about the local Little League team or the local newspaper that's been in business for 50 years, you start having the Conservative Opportunity Society, all led by Newt Gingrich, start talking about all of the horrible ways in which the Democrats are leading the House of Representatives. And what's happening is they're doing this in front of an empty House chamber. No one else is there except for the presiding officer. And so what people on the TV screen see is only this person railing against Democrats, and they don't ever see that the chamber is completely empty.
And this was C-SPAN.
C-SPAN, right. And so C-SPAN has the person saying all these horrible things about Democrats. People who are watching it don't know that the Republicans aren't there to rebut the charges. And so they say, well, the Democrats aren't there rebutting the charges, so they must be true. And so the fight, of course, escalates, because then at one point you have the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, who says that he's going to start panning the audience, and he doesn't tell the Republicans this. And so you'll have a Republican who's all red in the face because they're speaking with such gusto, and then it shows in a completely empty House chamber. And of course, then Newt Gingrich gets involved, and there's an entire fight that happens on the floor of the House, Newt Gingrich versus Tip O'Neill. And ultimately what happens is Tip O'Neill is applauded by all the Republicans in the House, except for a select few, including the House Minority Leader.
You said Tip O'Neill.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right. So Newt Gingrich was applauded by many of the Republicans. But one Republican who's not applauding is Bob Michael, who's the Republican leader in the House still. Because he's one of these people who said the only way that we're going to get things accomplished in the House of Representatives is we get along with Democrats. And he sees his entire strategy being confronted by Newt Gingrich. And he sees that he's losing control of his conference.
It wasn't even so much just to go along to get along, it seemed. It was just the entire decorum that Congress had become, which was, yeah, you can have these arguments about policy on the floor, but people then would dine together and get along together, and they weren't vicious.
And before this, it was very typical for a person to win in their 30s or 40s, their first election, and move the entire family, pack up the car, move everyone to Washington, D.C. And so what you would have is Democrats living right next to Republicans. Their children would play on the same Little League teams, they would go to school together. And so there was lots of social glue to kind of help the new members congeal once they got to Washington. But one of the things that Newt Gingrich does as soon as he comes to Washington is do not move here, because then you become part of this massive Washington, D.C. establishment, which we're going to run against. Instead, go home on the weekends, come to D.C., stay overnight actually in your office, use the showers in the House gym, stay here for two or three nights, and then go back to your districts. And that way we can portray the Democrats as being out of touch, being captured by the Washington, D.C. establishment. And to Newt Gingrich's credit, wildly successful, right? 1994, he becomes Speaker of the House because of the elections that happened that year.
And he did manage to topple the Democratic leader.
He did.
At the time.
That's right. Yep. So not only does he become Speaker, but the previous Speaker loses in the 1994 election. Tom Foley, the previous Speaker, the Democrat, loses in that election in a district in eastern Washington. Speaker Wright is Speaker, and Newt Gingrich rails against him for having the sweetheart book publishing deal. And it's a little bit ironic that this becomes the main criticism that Gingrich has used against Speaker Wright, because it's ultimately what in help causes Newt Gingrich's downfall in the late 1998 sweetheart publishing deal. Conflict escalates.
He becomes Speaker, but he sees that, as you said, his third priority.
That's right.
What were his real priorities?
Yeah, so for the first time, really, a speaker doesn't see themselves as being an institutionalist, the head of the whole House of Representatives, but rather, first and foremost, he is the leader of this movement, of the movement in America to reform politics. And secondly, he views himself as the leader of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives. And third, of course, is the Speaker of the House. It's interesting, though, because I think that Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner are certainly are more institutionalists than Newt Gingrich was. But I think both of them would view themselves equally as being in charge of the House of Representatives and the leader of their party. I think that they can't ever lose sight of the fact that they are the leader of the party because of the way that Newt Gingrich transforms what a speaker is supposed to do and be.
So in essence, what you then saw is all of these Republicans who were essentially trained by Newt Gingrich coming into the House and then moving to the Senate, right? But they're inspired by this tape that he's also put out there.
So Newt Gingrich, leading up to the 94 election, starting as early as the early 1980s, he's not only recruiting candidates to run, not only for the House of Representatives, but he's going even more local than that. He recognizes that in order to become a majority party in the House, you need to have qualified candidates run. In order to get qualified candidates, you need to start running good Republicans in city council elections, for county seats, at the local level. And he's not only recruiting candidates, but he's also telling them how to campaign. And he says, these are action words. These are words that you want to use because it's going to make you sound proactive. It's going to make you sound energetic. Don't use these words because they sound tired. They're going to play into to the way that Democrats talk about issues. Instead, we need to transform, right? We need to not talk about global warming, but rather climate change is an example of this. But we see how important these tapes are, even in the 2012 presidential election, when Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum are on stage together in the debates. And Rick Santorum says how instrumental and influential those early tapes were to how he thinks about politics. So here he is now, 25 years later, still being influenced by those early tapes that Newt Gingrich had given him even before he was in the House of Representatives.
And now we have, 40 senators that you call Gingrich senators that are sitting in the chambers now.
That's right. I think just two more. So 42.
So we have 42.
42. So Tim Scott and Jeff Flake.
I was very surprised that John McCain was one of them.
Yeah, isn't it interesting? John McCain has always been a tough case. I've been working on this project for 7-8 years, and there are times where I was like, oh man, John, he's everything that a Gingrich senator isn't. And then every now and then he acts exactly as a Gingrich senator does. And it's then that I see that even like in the genetic makeup of who John McCain is as a senator, sometimes it's too hard for him to resist those Gingrich lessons that everyone learned when they were in the House of Representatives.
He does cross over now and then.
And he does.
And part of what seems to be this sort of Gingrich senator manifesto is confront, block, and demean at every possible occasion.
That's right. Because it's the only way that they're going to become a majority party.
I think you called them both party polarizers and partisan warriors. Seems like that would almost be one and the same.
Yeah.
How are they different?
Right. How are they different? So it's one thing to vote conservatively. It's another thing to demean. And it's another thing to obstruct. And so they are certainly party polarized. They're conservative. In fact, of the 42 people who've been Gingrich senators who've served in the Senate, only two of them have been more moderate than the average Republican that they're serving with in the Senate. So just 2 out of 42. The other 40 have all been more conservative than the average Republican that they're serving with. And so certainly they vote conservatively. That's part of the story. But then there's another dimension, and that's to obstruct. It's sometimes to demean. Not everyone, of course, demeans, but it's obstruct. It's making things much more difficult than they otherwise need to be. It's not compromising at any level. In fact, it's standing in the way of compromise, making it more difficult for who the compromisers to compromise with Democrats.
And it's primarily, it seems like, to make the other party look bad.
It is. That's right. And what happens is that the margins, both in the House and the Senate, since 1994 have shrunk. And so every single election cycle since 1994, we're never quite sure which party's going to be in the majority. The one exception perhaps is 2008, when we were pretty certain that the Democrats were going to be, or in 2002, when we thought the Republicans were. But every other election cycle, we always think that the majority is up for grabs in the House and in the Senate. And so that introduces something into the dynamic of the way the institution operates, because it means, all right, if we compromise with Democrats, if we let them get this victory, that becomes something that they're going to be able to use against us. And so it's far better for us to stand in the way, make sure nothing good happens, hope that we become the majority party, so then we can drive the bus in the next Congress.
Similarly, as we've been saying, they've been blocking nominations. You say they have like this PAC mentality where they co-sponsor each other's bills, but nobody else's.
That's right.
Describe how the legislative process has actually changed and what the policy outcomes are.
No, that's right. So really interesting, and you have to be a pretty close observer of the Senate to see some of these changes. Of course, we all hear about cloturers and filibusters, but what's also happening in the Senate today is what they call death by amendment. And it's this endless introduction of amendments, forcing the leaders to go through 40 or 60 or 120 different amendments before they can finally take a final passage vote. And lots of these amendments have nothing to do with the underlying piece of legislation. Lots of them are strictly to get a Democrat to cast a vote on the wrong side of the issue so that their future competitor can run a campaign commercial that says, this person voted for tax increases 27 times. And then they can show all the times they have. And it's only because they're playing legislative games. Lots of these amendments have no chance of passing, but yet they still do it because taking a roll call on the floor of the Senate can take up to a half hour because you're still calling everyone's name, name by name by name. And so it takes a long time, and so they're standing in the way.
It's no wonder that the senators who were not of that ilk, the kind of more moderate Republicans especially, have left.
Right. I mean, Olympia Snowe, right, on the way out, it just can't even recognize not only the Senate as it's operating as an institution, but even her own conference, even the Republican conference. She admits as much on her way out the door, and she's grateful that she moves beyond. She thinks that she can have more influence from the outside.
Well, we'll see.
We will see.
I mean, we haven't seen much of her yet.
We haven't.
I think the jury's out on that, and I think it's probably unlikely that she can.
Right, and I think it's always easy on your way out the door to criticize all of your former colleagues. It's far harder to do that when you could actually have some
Unless you're
influence.
A Gingrich senator. You're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking with Sean Theriault about the so-called Gingrich senators. So there are a couple more examples I wanted to go into. One was when we were talking about the nominations that the president makes for their own cabinet and their own people. One example used was President Clinton's appointment to the Surgeon General.
Surgeon General. Right. What you have with Clinton's Surgeon General nominees is the first person he nominates is Jocelyn Elders. So here's a woman who's the granddaughter of sharecroppers, right? An African-American woman in the South who makes her way all through medical school at a time where there aren't many women, there aren't many African-Americans, let alone many African-American women. But ultimately, it's a fight to get her nomination confirmed. There are all sorts of people who are throwing up roadblocks. And sure enough, when you look at every one of the people who are throwing up roadblocks, every single one of them is a Gingrich senator. And so they're ultimately starting this campaign against her.
And do you get the sense it was organized?
It certainly was organized to get in the way of Jocelyn Elders. But what's never been explicitly clear to me is that the Gingrich senators look at each other and say, you're one of us, here's a wink and a nod, and we're going to get along. I think it's just much more of at the chromosomal genetic level at which they're learning politics in the House of Representatives. And they recognize, they're like, that guy thinks a lot about politics the way I do. You know, I bet we can get along on a lot of these different issues. And so there's this very, I think, informal network that starts developing among them.
And they did have a lot of common characteristics, too.
Oh, for sure. So when Jim DeMint, who we talked about earlier, resigns his seat, we get the first Gingrich senator who is not a white male. Right. So Tim Scott, who takes over Jim DeMint's seat, is an African-American, and he's the first person who's not a white male. And certainly the Senate, right, isn't short for white males. But there are plenty of Republican women in the Senate, and none of them came from the House in the era of Newt Gingrich. So the one that could come to mind is Olympia Snowe, who actually enters the House just before Newt Gingrich does.
Right. So what about the Alaska and Murkowski?
Right. So Lisa Murkowski, right? Not a member. She was a member of her own house in Alaska, but she never went through the House of Representatives.
Right.
Right. And she certainly, right, becomes ultimately a victim of the Tea Party senators, who I argue has a direct connection to the Gingrich senators.
Yeah, what is that connection? Some are maintaining their positions, but some of them are fading out.
That's right. So the Tea Party has been fascinating because as I was working on this project, I kept being more and more concerned that my class of Gingrich senators was going to fade into the background because of this new wave of Tea Party senators. And what we find is the Tea Parties couldn't have nearly the success that they had unless if it were for the Gingrich senators.
They were the trailblazers?
That's right. So two reasons, right? Certainly one, trailblazers. So they introduce a whole new series of strategies and tactics in the Senate that when the Tea Party comes along, they say, yeah, we see our friends who have done this. Now we're going to take that two or three more steps and we're going to push it even more. So there's that direct connection. But the second one is Jim DeMint. So Jim DeMint early on recognizes that these new reformers in the Republican Party who can shake things up. And so he starts planning all sorts of money in their campaigns. He by far contributes more to Republican senatorial campaigns than any other Republican senator. And it's only because of the direct influence of Jindal Mint that these people are winning their primaries. They're ultimately coming into the Senate, and they adopt Jindal Mint's politics.
They also have loyalty to him after all that.
They do.
Yeah.
And it's been fascinating for me to watch the dynamic that's happening in the Senate now that Jim DeMint has left. And what I think you see is some of these new Tea Party senators are picking up the Jim DeMint mantle and they're carrying it forward, right? So clearly on the in the media front, you have Rand Paul and then, of course, my own senator in Texas, Ted Cruz, who are absolutely out in front of the media. But you have Mike Lee, who's not someone who's on lots of TV screens or in newspapers, but absolutely doing all of the internal stuff that Jim DeMint was doing that makes compromise much more difficult, that is introducing roadblocks to getting legislation passed.
There was another incident that illustrates another tactic that I thought was quite fascinating and really important that we don't see in the public eye, and that was how they changed what you call the goalposts. In the middle of negotiations, one of these was with Obama's attempt to negotiate the reduction of arms treaty. What happened?
Yeah, so what happens is that for years and years, the main person in the Senate's look to for anything having to do with nuclear arms reduction was Dick Lugar. So Dick Lugar has always been the point person for the Republican Party. And what happens when Obama wants to do the New START is lots of Republicans start saying, you know, we're not going to listen to Dick Lugar. He has been a professed friend of Obama, and we can't have anyone that's friendly with the president be our point person. But furthermore, he represents the old Republican Party. And so they say our new spokesperson and our new point person on nuclear arms reduction is going to be John Kyle. And John Kyle did not serve on the appropriate committee that's hearing the New START. John Kyle had never been in the military himself. His background and knowledge of military systems was much less than Dick Lugar's, but yet he becomes the point person. And so he comes up with a list of five to seven different demands. And he says, I'm not going to sign off on this unless if you do these things. And Obama says, all right, you want this? I'll do this, plus I'll do more for you on that score. Item two, I'll meet you there. Item three, I'll do this and I'll go for
it. So because he's a compromise
guy.
That's
right. And so at the end of the day, he wants a new start. And if that means that he has to increase the amount of funding available for the arms, he's going to do it. If that means a closer eye on exactly what Russia's doing, he's going to ensure that there's that closer eye because he needs John Kyle's support. And so he agrees to all of this. And John Kyle ultimately says, you know what, there's just not enough time to evaluate this. And furthermore, the Obama team hasn't been as upfront with me as I wish they had been. And so Obama lists all of the different meetings that people in the White House have had with John Kyle, where they've talked him through all the different agreements, and John Kyle still doesn't sign off. And what happens in New START is there's enough Republicans, not very many Gingrich senators, incidentally, who ultimately decide that they're going to go with not only Obama, but also Dick Lugar, who becomes a big advocate of the START treaty, and it passes in a lame duck session days before the Congress ends.
So this could explain part of Obama's shift in his approach also,
because
he has no chance in this setting.
So, and it's right. You know, Obama is just mystified, and we can see the mystification that he feels because at time he's like,
even though he was in the Senate with a lot of them.
He was in the Senate with a lot of them, but he had a good working relationship with several Republicans when he comes. I mean, he and John McCain, once again, they were frenemies. They got along well on some issues, and then they had dueling press releases over campaign finance reform at one point. But Obama is caught between the strategy because he sees a Republican Party where some of the members are ready to compromise, and he sees a Republican Party where none of the members would ever compromise with him. And so one day he's having dinner with them, and then the next day he's castigating them in front of the media because he just doesn't know which Republicans he can possibly get on board, and if there's enough of them that can ultimately
was part of them pulling the rug out from under him?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And to
like playing games with him?
Sure, they're playing games with him. But to their credit, I mean, Obama's not reaching out to them at the early stages as much as they would like. I think even who I term the other Republicans would say that. But nonetheless, the Olympia Snows of the world, the Bob Corkers of the world, the Dick Lugars of the world, all those people who didn't come from Newt Gingrich's house are willing to sit down at a table with Obama. And Obama, at the end of the day, is a pragmatic problem solver. Obama's looking down at the Senate now, and he's looking at the Republicans who are left, and he's like, I'm not seeing many of those people left that I can talk to.
When you're talking about some of the other characteristics of them, you talked about their religion, their occupation, and very different from the past.
That's right.
Senators.
That's right.
And even this semi-secret religious organization,
yeah, right.
Which, by the way, I thought that some Democrats were part of.
There are some Democrats who are part of
even
it.
I heard Hillary Clinton.
Famously Hillary Clinton. It goes by different names in the media, the family, the fellowship is another name that it goes by. And people say that they, at the end of the day, are the people who are orchestrating all of these Republican tactics and everything that happens. And I take that hypothesis quite seriously in the book. And I say, all right, if that's true, I'm going to code all these people who have some association with the fellowship, and I'm going to see if their behavior changes. And lo and behold, when I compare them to the Gingrich senators are much more distinct from the other Republicans who are serving in the Senate than even the fellowship are. And so, however insidious some critics of the fellowship might think the fellowship is as an organization, the Gingrich senators are so much more distinct in the way.
So, do they all share a religion, or
no? So, I think that there are.
So they're mostly in the evangelical.
They're mostly Protestants. There are certainly a couple of Catholics, including Newt Gingrich, who famously converts to Catholicism. Rick Santorum is another Catholic.
And then another thing you noted was most of them, unlike the previous batch of senators, were not lawyers.
Right.
And they had some military service.
So they did, but the folks that came before them had more service typically. A lot of them come from business, were successful business people. And so that reformist, that anti-regulation, low tax ideology that they profess certainly rings true to their personal lives and the experiences that they've had. And so they're clearly receptive to Newt Gingrich's message on those ideological grounds.
I was wondering about the current House now compared to the Senate, and how many of, say, the John Boehners and those types also sort of cut their teeth on Newt Gingrich ideology. They certainly walk like a Gingrich senator,
right.
Even though they're in the House instead.
They certainly do,
Is there a big wave of them that are being trained as we speak?
For sure. So what happens is that in my investigation of the Gingrich senators, what I find is that it didn't matter if they served in the House for 2 years or 4 years or 6 years. It didn't matter if they served on the same committees as Newt Gingrich. It didn't matter if they came after he became speaker, before he became speaker. It was just being in the Republican conference that had been radically transformed by Newt Gingrich. And so no doubt, even those people who don't go on to the Senate enter that same Republican conference that was radically transformed, including John Boehner, case in point. But what happens to John Boehner is this mentality exists for lots of years, but then we get to the 2010 election and the introduction of the Tea Party. And the Tea Party is certainly a new breed that John Boehner is like, whoa, like, I just got my hands wrapped around this mentality of Gingrichness, and now I have an entirely new set of folks that I have to try and figure out how I can try and be a leader to them. And I think that he's been dumbfounded these past few years in trying to figure out how it is that he can lead a Republican conference that has a lot of these Gingrich senators, but also people who've taken that message and walked two steps to the right in our Tea Party folks.
What does it say about the electorate that they keep putting these people back in office?
That's right.
And do you see that continuing in the future? Or do you see, like, such wreckage coming out of this?
What I do in the conclusion is I say, for those of you that like the Republican Party, being confrontational, standing up for its beliefs, getting in the way of compromise, congratulations. Like, that is the party that you now have. And if you're a Republican and you don't like that, then you need to employ the exact same instrument that Jim DeMint did. When he didn't like the kind of Republicans that he was serving with, he went to the electorate and said, I want you to send me some new breed folks. The electorate listened to him. They responded, and new breed Republicans were elected. So to the Republicans today who don't like the way the Republican Party is going, they need to take back their party. They need to show up in primaries. They need to make sure that these Main Street moderate Republicans who continue to run are elected and then have a chance of winning the general election. And until the electorate makes that decision, we're going to continue to have crash and burn politics, brinksmanship, striking deals at the 11th hour or even after the 12th hour has expired, and then making
And you left out like the whole other side of U.S. electorate, which are people who don't really agree with the Republican politics in the first place.
That's right. And what we don't find is that the Democrat Party We don't find the bifurcation in the Democratic Party that we have in the Republican Party. In fact, the Democrats who come to the Senate from the House look a whole lot like the Democrats who don't come from the House. And so we can't see that same type of mentality. And clearly, there are liberal Democrats and there are moderate Democrats, but we can't trace their characteristics as cleanly as I can the Gingrich senators to their service in the House of Representatives. Right.
Thank you, Sean Theriault, for being with us and talking about your new book, The Gingrich Senators, The Roots of Partisan Warfare in Congress.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. It's a pleasure being here today.
When we come back, how memory entrepreneurs are working to change how you remember the past as a means to shape the future. Stay tuned.
Get your crazy hand on my bill of rights. It was written right. You can't make it wrong. You can't stop me singing. Liz True, Lonesome Soul. Oh no. Take your hands off it. You know it don't belong to you. Get your crazy, stinking hands off my voting rights. I vote how I please. I vote how I choose. You can spend your money, but in the end, you're bound to lose. I think you will.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Can reconfiguring our memories of the past affect the future? Has memory itself become a political battleground? Some political scientists have found that so-called memory entrepreneurs try to reshape our memories as a means to advance particular policy agendas. One of these battles has been the effort to shape our memories of the Cold War, to have it remembered as a good fight, like World War II. In which good triumphed over evil. How has this battle been waged, and has it been successful? John Wiener joins us now. He's a professor of history at the University of California at Irvine. He's the author of numerous books, including Gimme Some Truth, The John Lennon FBI Files, and his latest, How We Forgot the Cold War, A Historical Journey Across America. Ellen Schrecker is also with us. She is a professor of history at Yeshiva University and the author of several books, including Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and The Age of McCarthyism, A Brief History with Documents. Doug Becker is also with us. He is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. Among his publications are The Bush Administration's Campaign Against the International Criminal Court and also The Use of Memory and Trauma in Foreign Policymaking, which has been Memory and Trauma in International Relations. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar's Circle. It's great to have you. Doug Becker, I want to start with you. You put this idea of official memory and shaping historical memory into a political context, almost like a political tool, and it's changed over the years. How would you say it has been changing, and what have been the effects?
Thank you for having me. History is certainly not static by any stretch of the imagination. Our understandings are the lessons that we draw from history, even certainly questions about causations within history will change. And although any good historian will certainly tell you they'll change because evidence is changing and because our knowledge of patterns from the past have changed, also there are social and political causes for those change. Specifically, history is used by contemporary political actors. It's certainly a component for contemporary political actors about shaping identity, about learning lessons from the past, about trying to blunt criticism for current policies, trying to draw a linkage between your current policy preferences and something that happened in the past. Some of this is natural. I mean, the idea that contexts of history, the lessons of history, the meanings within history will change generationally, will change over the years, is a natural organic process. But it's not always simply natural and organic. And there are certainly individuals with vested political interests in either maintaining old historical narratives are creating new historical narratives, adjusting the contemporary narratives. The term that we use for those are memory entrepreneurs. And one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is, first, why would a memory entrepreneur try to alter our understandings within history, try to create a new narrative. But also, I want to caution us that an attempt to alter history by a memory entrepreneur doesn't alter it. What it does is it creates an arena of political contestation. And sometimes it becomes dialectical, left versus right, and you know, something that Hegel would certainly be proud of. But in some cases, it can be very multifaceted. And the ways in which political actors will take these attempts at altering history, either to directly confront it, reject it, or manipulate it for their own benefits. So the lessons here is, if history's changing, asks whose interest is it to change? Who's trying to change it? And then how can contemporary political actors go with these changes to serve their current political preferences?
Ellen Schrecker, would you agree with this?
I think so, though I think the way Doug is presenting this is as if there are sort of individuals out there with some kind of agenda. And I think it's much more a question of what can history be used for. I'm just teaching a course now. We're just getting up to Vietnam. I teach contemporary American history. And this is the moment at which American policymakers, in order to justify a military escalation in Vietnam, begin to talk about Munich. That's the lesson that they want to bring from history to show that we've got to stand up to whatever it is we have to stand up to. So you can do almost anything with history to justify a current practice. But in the hands of policymakers, you see often a distortion and a focus on certain lessons and a totally ignoring other lessons or other moments.
Well, that's actually the perfect place to bring in John Wiener, who's just written this book, How We Forgot the Cold War, A Historical Journey Across America, which speaks to this exactly.
I love Doug's concept of memory entrepreneurs. And one of the things I was interested in my book, How We Forgot the Cold War, was the efforts of, in particular, mainstream conservative memory entrepreneurs to shape the public understanding of the Cold War. The idea they presented is a very coherent one, a very comprehensive one. The Cold War, you may have heard this before, was a battle between freedom and slavery, between good and evil. The United States triumphed because one man in particular, Ronald Reagan, remained true to his values and refused to compromise with evil, unlike certain other people we could mention. Richard Nixon, for example, with the detente. Reagan went to the Brandenburg Gate. Reagan said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And they did. Good triumphed over evil, the end. In my book, I set out on a trip across the United States to visit monuments and museums and memorials about the Cold War to see how this message was going over with the public. And what I found was that the public wasn't really remembering the Cold War at all. The public was forgetting about the Cold War, that the efforts of the, let's call them Reaganite memory entrepreneurs in this case, don't seem to have succeeded. I found somewhere between, I don't know, skepticism, apathy, and maybe some resistance to this notion.
You spoke specifically, or you wrote, I should say, specifically about this legacy resource management program. What was the scope of this?
That sounds kind of bureaucratic, doesn't it?
I mean, was it just these memorials or was there more to it?
This was like the very day that the Soviet Union collapsed. Congress was aware and passed legislation in the Defense Appropriation Act, we're in 1991 now, to create the public memory of the Cold War. And this was not just through museums, monuments, memorials, but through archival records and all kinds of things that we want them to do. Clearly, they were aware of the political value of creating a certain definition of the Cold War. And I want to emphasize, I've been calling this the Reaganite definition, but really it was completely bipartisan. I'm sure when Ellen Schrecker teaches this course, she teaches the Democrats were just as much a part of this idea that we need to have a nuclear deterrent to defend freedom and that the military budgets are an unfortunate necessity. And starting with Harry Truman in 1947, right through Bill Clinton, we find bipartisan consensus about the importance of conveying to the public this way of understanding the Cold War and what it means.
Ellen Schrecker?
It's a very highly militarized notion of the Cold War, which I think is a lot of what John was finding, that so many of these places that he was visiting were on military bases, had something to do with this militarization of American foreign policy that the Cold War brought about. And that's something that obviously falls away when we talk about the Cold War, because it's often presented, I know I see this with my own students, as a kind of morality play. And a lot of what is popular history out there does come through in a very oversimplified, you know, good guys versus bad guys kind of way that drives historians up the wall. This is not the way we like to think about history.
Doug Becker, you have done quite a bit of research on Reagan and the development of his legacy. You had a name for it, too. I think it was called something like the Ronald Reagan Legacy Project. How does this comport with what you found?
No, it actually fits it rather well. There's one point I want to make about this question of the morality play. One of the great ironies is certainly within international relations, the traditional school of realism, and who's always credited with being the father of containment, George Kennan, always complained about the moral components of containment and the way the morality play plays itself out, which raises an interesting question when we create a history that the reason why the U.S. won the Cold War was because of containment, because of hard-headed, you know, hard-reasoned rationalist policies, when in reality, both the historians and the policymakers themselves seem to be rather emotional in that response. But to your question about the Reagan Legacy Project, yeah, I mean, the idea that you would finger an individual, at one level, certainly individuals have a key role to play, but it's rare that a single individual could have a significant impact. But in the case of the Reagan Legacy Project, there actually was. It was the brainchild, at least in its contemporary form, of Grover Norquist, who we all know quite well. And it was in 1997, and the direct political interest in his project was a collective coming to grips with the fact that they just lost a second presidential election to Bill Clinton and wanted to emphasize that Ronald Reagan was the direct opposite of Clinton, that he was moral. You know, he stuck to his guns. He was the sort of leader that stood by moral guideposts. And at one level, what Norquist wanted to do was name one thing after Ronald Reagan in every county in America. And that's why you start seeing all these things named. So when you examine the contemporary political motivations for this, the use of Munich as a justification to intervene in any sort of conflict because every individual that might threaten the peace is the new Hitler, and also the militarized response. I'm always struck by the use of, you know, a term that gets used in the neoconservative community is a neo-Reaganite foreign policy. And they used it to justify military intervention in Iraq, despite the fact, I mean, the historical record is quite clear. The only time Ronald Reagan ever used the military was to invade tiny Grenada. And most historians and political scientists alike believe that that had much more to do with domestic politics and the collective concern about what would happen as a result of the bombing in Beirut, as opposed to freeing this tiny nation of its communist overlord. So,
John Weiner.
I'm very interested in this whole issue of the Ronald Reagan Legacy Project and where it stands today. If you go out to Simi Valley, where the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum is, this is the white-hot heart of Reagan memory in the world. This is the place, above all others, where we should hear about Reagan's lifelong commitment to fighting evil. What we find is that the Reagan Library has kind of lost confidence that people will come out there to hear about Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall. They think what people want to hear about is Walt Disney. And indeed, their attendance doubled after they opened the Walt Disney exhibit. They do have exhibits about Reagan and the Cold War and the Berlin Wall, and there's a little corner about Grenada if you want to read the fine print. But what is big is an exhibit on the history of Walt Disney, the largest temporary exhibit they've ever had at the Reagan Library. Why? What does this have to do with Ronald Reagan? The answer is virtually nothing. The show is organized not by the National Archives, which operates the Reagan Library, and The mission of the National Archives is to preserve the records and history of the people of the United States of America. This exhibit was organized by the Walt Disney Fan Club. This is a sign that the memory entrepreneurs are not succeeding at their mission and they're having to look elsewhere.
Well, we keep mentioning tear down this wall and crediting Ronald Reagan with this. Ellen Schrecker, perhaps you can set the record straight for us. What did happen? Did Ronald Reagan tear down this wall?
I'm afraid not, but what did happen was that the Soviet Union crumbled from within because of a whole bunch of reasons. It was unsustainable, technology was back, all kinds of internal reasons. It was a very rigid system that promoted all kinds of cheating. And what the triumphalist, you know, your true believers in Reagan as the architect of the end of the evil empire, is based on the notion that when Ronald Reagan decides to adopt the technology of Star Wars, which most people probably don't remember, it was something called the Strategic Defense Initiative, and the idea was to create a huge shield of missiles that would shoot down Soviet missiles whenever they came over. Reagan pumps a lot of money in it, essentially daring the Soviets to match him in military spending on this very fancy technology that doesn't seem to work. The idea was that Reagan had kind of spent the Soviet Union into bankruptcy, and that's why the wall came down. It's a much more complicated issue than that and owes a lot more to the inherent problems of the Soviet system than it does to a rather late attempt on the part of Ronald Reagan to quote-unquote spend the evil empire into destruction. But this has become the kind of mantra of Cold War triumphalists, that Reagan, by creating this very strange defense system that doesn't work, defeated the Soviet Union.
Doug Becker?
I find it very interesting that the Reagan Library has this concern about trying to get folks to come out there. And the people who I know who've gone out to the library typically go because they want to see the replica of Air Force One that's there. But what I find that's quite striking is the Reagan Triumphal School is certainly a component of political ideology in the United States. Whether the Soviet Union crumbled or Reagan caused it to crumble, how you would answer that question is, I would suspect, is very strongly correlated to general political preferences, whether you're a conservative or a liberal, Democrat or Republican. But the thing that I find quite striking is that the lesson of the Triumphal School, that words matter, that ideas matter, and that a speech can change world events, replays itself in the Arab Spring. As Arab governments are certainly being toppled, in essence, have both the left and right arguing that their leader, whether it was George Bush's freedom agenda or Barack Obama's speech at Cairo, is the one that's most responsible for that. So both parties are wrapping themselves up in that lesson. But the real concern I had for this was not the question of whether Reagan was a great president or not, but if Reagan was a great president because he ushered in the end of the Cold War, I think most historians and political scientists alike would agree that Reagan's greatness lie not with delivering a speech and refusing to negotiate with evil, but because Reagan recognized that the Soviet Union had changed, that Gorbachev was a different type of leader, someone that the U.S. could do business with. And although that isn't what caused the collapse of the Soviet Union, it certainly advanced American interests with things like the Intermediate Range Nuclear Force Treaty and the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaties, etc. And the linkages that Gorbachev had with the West certainly constrained the Soviets' policy options once the wall starts to crumble. So if it was deft diplomacy on the part of Reagan and then Bush, how interesting, by the way, Bush is never given credit for the end of the Cold War.
Although he does have a piece of the wall, I understand.
Yeah, apparently. But what's interesting is if there's a lesson to be learned, it's exactly the opposite lesson of things like the axis of evil speech, where you declare Iran evil and then say, we're going to stand up, and then Iran's going to get rid of their nuclear program, as opposed to negotiating with Iran. Dare I say, if Reagan were president today, he would be considerably more open to the notion of negotiation with Iran than certainly his conservative descendants would suggest that he would be.
Who often use his name as their representative. So this Reagan idea and the memorial is one of, what, two dozen that John Wiener actually went to and looked at to try to get a sense about this memory that was being shaped, this official memory in how we forgot the Cold War. I was struck by what was included, but also what was left out. We talked about a couple of these before we started the tape. What did you find most remarkable about what was left out and who was left out?
Let me just stick with this Berlin Wall thing for a minute. The Berlin Wall is the great icon of the end of the Cold War and of America's victory in the Cold War and of Reagan going to the Brandenburg Gate and giving his speech. There's something like 40 different places in the United States that display segments of the Berlin Wall. Here, we're in Southern California. There's at least half a dozen spots in Los Angeles or in the LA area that have Berlin Wall exhibits. And indeed, it is a powerful object. And indeed, it did separate a totalitarian state from capitalist democratic state. But when I visited some of these sites around the country, it's just remarkable how many ways the significance of the Berlin Wall is explained and how few of them mention Ronald Reagan. For example, Ellen Schrecker right now speaking to us from Manhattan on East 53rd Street, there's a Westpocket Park that displays a piece of the Berlin Wall. And what the historical marker there says is that this wall marked the border between East and West Germany from 1962 to 1989, period. A border, like the border, I guess, between Canada and the United States. Not the border between slavery and freedom. Not the border between good and evil. That's all they have to say about it. They don't mention Ronald Reagan. There's another segment of it at the Microsoft campus outside of Seattle. Microsoft has a big art collection. They have a piece of the Berlin Wall that they exhibit, and they say they're exhibiting it because it's a work of graffiti art. And indeed, there is graffiti all over most of the Berlin Wall segments. And again, they don't mention Ronald Reagan at all or slavery or freedom. The most remarkable one I found is in Las Vegas at one of the more downscale casinos, the Main Street Station Casino, which is in the, let's call it, the budget area of Las Vegas, downtown. They have an exhibit called Pee on the Berlin Wall. And their segment is in the men's room behind the urinals. And they say, gentlemen, pee on the Berlin Wall. It's one of the reasons to go to this casino. So what's left out? Ronald Reagan.
So you've gone to what, to 24?
Something like that.
So about 24 memorials that were dedicated to the Cold War. And if you were going to make a composite of them, and you were going to draw a picture, you as a person who was trying to understand the Cold War by these, what are the big missing pieces and what are the big emphases?
What I found was there's basically three different varieties of these. There's the sort of the true believer exhibits that hold to the, we could call it the Reaganite narrative here. And those are pretty much empty and forlorn and nobody goes there. Nobody wants to hear about it. Then there are the ones that they're sort of entrepreneurial zeal where they change their focus to some other part of history. For instance, there's a Winston Churchill memorial in the middle of Missouri where Churchill gave that famous speech from Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, and Iron Curtain has descended across the continent. They built a museum at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, place where he gave that speech, but nobody came. But they changed that museum. Now it is a museum of I have nothing to offer but blood, sweat, and tears. It's about the Battle of Britain. It's about the Royal Air Force. It's about their finest hour. That's the story that people would rather hear about Winston Churchill. They don't really want to hear about the Iron Curtain. And then there's still other places where the Cold War is just a pretext for something completely different. If you drive down the 5 freeway in California to San Diego, there's a huge cross on a hilltop, a 40-foot-high cross. The ACLU has been litigating for decades to have this removed. It's on public property, and it's a violation of the separation of church and state. The people who built the cross say it's a Korean War memorial. Now, really, it doesn't have anything to do with the Korean War. Really, it is a religious object. But they are using the Cold War as a pretext to defend something which otherwise would get them in trouble.
What I'm gathering from you is this a very disparate story that is being told, and it's not being told very well, and it's not really very convincing. Ellen Schrecker, what do you make of this?
There's some pieces of history that people seem attracted to, and it really follows current political events. For example, I took my granddaughters to go see the movie about Lincoln. Now, why is a movie about Lincoln coming out now? Obviously, it's pushing 200 years. But I think this movie at this time is also telling us something about race relations in the United States at a moment when we have, for the first time, an African-American president. So I just wonder about a question of timing. What historical moments get dealt with at what times? And it seems to me that popular culture often picks up things that, even though sort of what you call triumphalist entrepreneurs or whatever may be pushing, it's not going to get picked up. If there's something else going on, that there's a contemporary story, and if it can get grafted onto some historical moment, then it probably will be.
John Weider's conclusion was ultimately that this effort has more or less failed, which is clear by How We Forgot the Cold War, the title. But there are some other efforts that seem wildly successful, and we've been speaking about Ronald Reagan. That seems to be one of them. And Doug Becker, you have written about this, how many people invoke Ronald Reagan when they give a speech, how many freeways they try to name after him, and even a mountain. Why do we have such a failure on memory entrepreneurship on the Cold War versus somebody like Ronald Reagan?
There's a couple things going on. First of all, what you're finding with respect to Reagan's role at ending the Cold War and the Cold War itself is this arena of political contestation. There's been a pushback, and at least at one level, I think it's fair to say that the Reagan Triumphal School, that they overplayed their hand by making the argument so blatant and also, quite frankly, so partisan that that's part of the reason for the pushback. Another part, though, I think, is that people aren't terribly interested in the details of the history of the Cold War, yet they've drawn conclusions on how the Cold War has ended and those processes without any sort of background. You ask somebody about the invasion of Grenada, and they'll answer it was to free the country from communists. You ask somebody about the Cuban Missile Crisis, it was to free the country from communists. Very, very simple sort of explanation, so that superficially this memory continues. But it's not terribly detailed, it's not terribly deep, it's not terribly nuanced, and it certainly would never meet the standard that any historian would hold it to in terms of being a narrative per se. It's not as much a narrative as, quite frankly, more like a cartoon. It still gets invoked, and it's still this arena of intense contestation, but it is interesting that it's fading, and maybe the lesson here is that memorials aren't terribly successful any longer at the creation of memory.
Well, there are plenty more vignettes that we didn't get to in How We Forgot the Cold War, and some very important ones, I thought, John Weiner, including the, as we talked about, the CIA memorial and the Second Security Memorial, very
National
important.
National Security Agency in Maryland has and a museum.
And the memorial to the so-called victims of the Cold War. But we're just going to have to cover that another time. I'd like to thank our three scholars, Ellen Schrecker, John Weiner, and Doug Becker. Thank you all so much. John Weiner is a professor of history at the University of California at Irvine. He's the author of numerous books, including Gimme Some Truth, The John Lennon FBI Files, and How We Forgot the Cold War, A Historical Journey Across America. Ellen Schrecker is a professor of history at Yeshiva University and the author of several books, including Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and The Age of McCarthyism, A Brief History with Documents. Doug Becker is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. Among his publications are The Bush Administration's Campaign Against the International Criminal Court, and also The Use of Memory and Trauma in Foreign Policymaking, which has been Memory and Trauma in International Relations. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankine Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @Armudian.